The consequences for our country are much too grave for us not to be able to find the solution. So it is my great honor to be here with you. There is a debate in Washington that could lead to a reduction in the National Institutes of Health budget. Just unbelievable that we're even having this discussion. We have to ensure that we give to the smartest people in our country the tools which they need in order to be successful. And we are very fortunate. We are very fortunate. Because today I have the honor of introducing Dr. Francis Collins, the director of the National Institutes of Health, which are really the National Institutes of Hope for families all across our country and all across the world. Through research, we hope to find treatments and cures, and Dr. Collins has not only continued this legacy of hope through his visionary and collaborative leadership, but he has extended it. Dr. Collins cracked the human genome. He is the maestro of the most amazing discovery of our time. His work fundamentally changed our understanding of our own biological makeup. He is a scientific giant among the most gifted and innovative researchers in the entire world. That is why our country is fortunate to have him as the head of the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Collins's own research laboratory has also discovered a number of important genes, including those responsible for cystic fibrosis, Huntington's disease, a familial endocrine cancer syndrome, and most recently, genes for type 2 diabetes. Just last week, in testimony to the United States Senate, Dr. Collins wisely sounded the alarm about the urgent need for research funding so that the world's most talented scientists stay here and start laboratories here in the United States. We are lucky to have such a bold, forward-thinking leader in the National Institutes of Health, a strong advocate for basic science as well as translational science to make sure that our investments lead to tangible outcomes and therapeutic developments. I want to praise Dr. Collins's emphasis on bringing scientists together from various disciplines to tackle big picture problems. He is willing to take on extraordinary projects and to get extraordinary results. Whether on his guitar or in the laboratory, he is truly a rock star of science. It is my pleasure and honor to introduce the great Dr. Francis Collins.
As I have Dr. Collins join me at the podium here, I'd also like to invite another family member who's here with her husband and daughter to join us for a minute because she's a busy person carrying on the great legacy of her father, which we're also using in this conference to rebrand the mission to space, this time to inner space. And I'm so honored that my cousin Caroline could join us after awarding the Profile and Courage Award this morning in her father's memory. Would you all join me in please welcoming my cousin Caroline Kennedy Schlossberg? She's just like, you know, what are you doing to me? But I want to tell you a small story, and that was when I heard that this year they were going to celebrate the new frontier, John F. Kennedy's bold vision in the 1960s. I immediately thought about all of you who over the years talked about the brain as the last medical frontier. So I called Caroline up. I made a really bold proposition. Do you think we can have the John F. Kennedy Library for January 20th in order to celebrate the next frontier, which is the brain. She said, that sounds like a great idea, Patrick, but we've got the president doing something, we've got this rolled out, we're at the Capitol with all the congressional leaders. Do you mind picking another date? But then she followed up with a great idea. She says, how about the anniversary of the moonshot speech? And in a sense, the moonshot speech really epitomized for most Americans viscerally what a bold scientific endeavor looks like through presidential leadership. And her father's leadership at that time was called into question by many because they thought what he was proposing was too bold. And his answer a year and a half later in Rice University was, we don't do these things because they're easy, we do them because they're hard. Ladies and gentlemen, I will tell you, she has an enormous legacy to carry on, and she does it with such grace and dignity that every day gives honor to the amazing legacy of her father. Give another great round of applause for my cousin Caroline.
Well, thank you all. Thank you, Patrick, for that. I'm so honored that this conference is going to wind up at the Kennedy Library on May 25th, and I want to congratulate Patrick for all the work and the passion and the commitment that he has put into this. There is no more important issue, and I think that one of the things I learned from his father and my own was always to look ahead, and I think that there couldn't be a better use of my father's commitment to send a man to the moon and all the scientific work that went into that than to put that same kind of effort towards the brain and neuroscience and the work that you're all doing. So we're all honored to be a part of Patrick's vision and the work here, and I'm honored to do anything we can to support it. So thanks so much for having us.
Now, Francis Collins has the dubious job of, a minute ago, he was the big wheel. How in the world is he going to follow that? So all of us are all have our own little, you know, spot in the world where we think we're a big deal. At this conference, hopefully we all understand our proper role, and that's we're only important as it relates to us working together. And to deliver that message is our NIH director, Francis Collins.
Yes, I will have to add to my list of people never to try to speak after anybody in the Kennedy family, my gosh. That was wonderful to hear from Caroline, and Congressman Markey, thank you for those incredibly generous words and for your inspiring words to all of us. And Patrick, I just want to say how amazing the role you have played has turned out to be here during this 2.5 days. Of a focus on the science of the mind and all that that means for understanding how our brains work and, most importantly, what to do when injuries occur or when disease strikes. You have brought this into a focus that was desperately needed at this time, and you've pointed to the opportunities scientifically that I think many people are not fully aware of that make this a remarkable moment to launch a new effort. Just as JFK, just about 50 years ago, come a couple of days from now, launched a similar effort that people thought was also awfully audacious. But we should be audacious. And I'm delighted to be able to be here as part of that and to also express thanks to others who have worked so hard to make this event come together and to have this 10-year plan put in place. And I particularly want to recognize Steve Hyman, who has worked very hard on this. And also, yeah. And also my colleagues from NIH who have been working hard on this. Story Landis, who is over here, Tom Insel, Richard Hodes, and Nora Volkow, who's right here. And this, I think, is a challenge to try to put into a brief 30 minutes, which should have started, you know, an hour ago, about exactly how NIH, or at least its director, might view this opportunity. And I will try, if I can, to touch on a few areas that I thought were particularly exciting, but I will nowhere near capture even the things that have already happened at this meeting of this morning. That stuff on the connectome was breathtaking, and the way in which that field, exemplary of so many others, is moving forward at a pace not really imagined even a few years ago, is what we're all here to celebrate, and also what we're here to try to make sure we're planning effectively to make the most of. So we are, at NIH, devoted to a mission which encompasses this entire spectrum, from the fundamental knowledge about the nature and behavior of living systems, the basic science. And let's be clear, if you really want to understand the brain, there's so much basic science we need to do. At the same time, when we have the opportunity to apply that to the prevention and treatment of disease, that is also our mission. That is what the public expects us to do. That's what all of us are passionate about seeing happen. So the challenge is always to try to get the balance right. And we're not always sure at any given moment whether we have it right, but we do what we can with the scientific information available to try to make the best bets on the science that is going to be most productive, even in the face, as is particularly the case now, of challenging financial constraints. I want to talk about three areas of innovation in NIH science right now, and give you some examples of ways in which I believe they are highly relevant to this conference. So first, let's talk about the way in which new technologies are making it possible to accelerate the pace of discovery. Technologies that come from many different directions, many of them invented only in the last few years, and now able in some instances to be applied at scale to teach us comprehensive answers to questions that we were almost afraid to pose a decade or more ago because we thought it would just be too frustrating to be able to go there. We can go there now. So those have led us, through the abilities to survey the causes of disease, to discover now, in the space of just the last few years, the molecular basis of about 4,000 diseases that we didn't know about 25 years ago. The pace of that curve is truly remarkable. Many of these are diseases caused by mutations in single genes, some of them a little more complicated. And that's the good news. 4,000 of those we now know the cause of, but for only about 200 do we have any therapy available. So that is an opportunity, but a very serious responsibility, to take that molecular information and move it forward as quickly as we can. For common diseases that fill up our hospitals and clinics, that cause so much suffering for individuals and families, and enormous economic costs to our nation and to our world, we also have seen a remarkable revolution, and I'm sure the panel that follows me that talks about genetics will have a lot to say about this. What you're looking at there is a cartoon of the human chromosomes, 1 through 22, and the X and the Y, and each one of those colored circles is a discovery of a variation in the genome that's common in our population that plays a role in risk of a common disease. So diabetes is on there, the common cancers are on there, yes, and Alzheimer's is on there, and Parkinson's disease, and multiple sclerosis, and schizophrenia. Let's just look at Alzheimer's, for instance. We knew about the APOE gene, but now very recently, in the last year or so, these new genetic risk variants have turned up because of the ability to do genome-wide association studies, or GWAS. And that list of genes, which looks like a lot of gibberish, although I'm glad one of them is called CLUE, because it must be a clue, those are pointing us in directions that we would not have guessed. The beauty of this is you don't have to start knowing the answer. You are scanning the entire genome, looking for the places where risks of Alzheimer's reside, and they don't turn out to be what you would have guessed, because on that list are genes that seem to be involved in inflammation. And that was not really a hypothesis that had a whole lot of purchase until this began to pop up. And it sends us potentially in a new direction as far as ideas about pathogenesis and maybe about prevention and treatment. Other genes involved in cholesterol pop up here. And of course, yes, some involved in synaptogenesis. You might expect that for a brain disease. But it opens up a whole new window, a window that is not framed on the basis of prior hypotheses, but generates new hypotheses. So there's a great opportunity on that slide with more than 1,000 of these new discoveries about common disease. But of course, a huge challenge to figure out which of those are pointing us towards the next ideas about treatment, and that's where we are right now. not only can we find those common variants, like the ones I just showed you, but we also are looking for those rare variants that have a large effect, which have been somewhat outside of our reach in many instances. But look at this curve in terms of the way in which the cost of doing DNA sequencing has plummeted since that first draft of the human genome was generated just about 10 years ago. That first one cost us about $400 million. I could now sequence your genome for about $8,000. And that number is dropping progressively and will clearly be below $1,000 in the next 4 to 5 years. As you can see from this curve, that means the cost of DNA sequencing is progressing more rapidly than Moore's Law, which is both something we're very excited about being able to crow about, but also a little worried because we're generating more data sometimes than we know what to do with. So there's a huge challenge here in the computational arena to keep track of all this, but a challenge that's actually a lot of fun to try to address. This means that you can now go after diseases that were so rare that you couldn't really attack their cause simply by sequencing complete genomes. Here's just one example, one of the early ones, and one that happens to involve the brain, of seeking out the cause of a genetic condition called Kabuki syndrome, characterized by a distinct facial appearance. And it was possible to use sequencing of all the protein-coding parts of the genome, the exome, in a number of patients to identify the fact that this is caused by a gene called MLL2. And from the diagram, there are multiple different ways that MLL2 can go awry, and they all cause this particular condition. You are going to see a proliferation of these kinds of discoveries about quite rare conditions in the course of the next couple of years as people apply exome and whole genome sequencing to such conditions. And I think those are not just curiosities. Those are going to be instances that shed light upon fundamental aspects of the brain that would be hard to come by otherwise. And they will be fundamental aspects about the human brain, because that is where this effort will be most vigorously applied. And I would be hard-pressed to conclude that this is going to teach us things about prevention and therapy in ways that maybe right now we can't quite anticipate, but will come forward. In addition to looking at DNA and the way in which mutations in DNA cause various kinds of outcomes, we have the opportunity, because of technology, also to be able to look at the RNA, the message that comes from that instruction book. This transcriptional atlas of human brain development, a major NIH project funded by the Recovery Act, at least initially, aims to try to map gene expression in normal brain during development as well as in adulthood. And it allows then an opportunity for investigators who will all have immediate access to this as a public database to see which genes are turned on where in specific segments of the brain in a systematic, high-quality fashion. And this will be very much, and you can already go and look at what's there in the database, facilitated by a website that allows any investigator with interest in particular parts of the brain or particular disorders to be able to see what information can be gleaned from this. The sort of thing that individual investigators would have taken decades to be able to generate, but which in this systematic, organized consortium can be done much more quickly and made freely available. And of course, another technology that no doubt will be of source of great interest during the course of this meeting is the ability to take embryonic stem cells and differentiate them down various pathways into different cell types, benefited by the fact that they are also self-renewing. And obviously, the potential this creates for opportunities in therapeutics is both breathtaking and largely uncharted, with so far just one trial having enrolled 2 patients for the treatment of spinal cord injury, something that we all look forward to learning about, but which is certainly a very early stage in the therapeutic application. We at NIH have just founded a Center for Regenerative Medicine, which aims to try to apply human embryonic stem cell and induced pluripotent stem cell therapeutics in a way that takes advantage of our clinical center, a 240-bed research hospital, as a really natural place to undertake some of these bold new ideas about therapeutics, with all that that entails in terms of the kind of clinical care that will be necessary and the serious risks that things may go wrong. This is very much in the early stage of contemplation. Imaging, you saw so dramatically demonstrated this morning if you were here for the connectomics presentation. And there's so many things that one could point to, both at the cellular level and at the whole brain level, that are giving us views of function and how that connects with structure in ways that I would not have imagined a decade ago. I'm going to give a couple of examples in the course of what I have to say about the way in which these have been applied, particularly to traumatic brain injuries. In this particular instance, I'm highlighting a resting state fMRI study to look at what happens to athletes after a concussion, where in general it has been assumed that after a concussion sustained in a sports activity, that once the symptoms have disappeared, everything is fine. The way in which this study was carried out tested that by looking, using fMRI, whether in fact brain functions were normal within 10 days after that injury. There's a lot of complex data analysis in this paper, but ultimately, in this diagram, if you look at the top, that was the normal controls, and the ones below come from individuals who had sustained a concussion as part of a sports activity. And there seemed to be particularly a longer standing difficulty in conveying information from one hemisphere to the other in those who had sustained that concussion, which is an interesting and somewhat unexpected result, and suggests that the consequences of brain injury of this sort may be more long-standing than anyone had previously appreciated. So technologies, which I know are going to be a theme at this, and they should be, because I think we should always look at history and notice the way in which technology has often preceded breakthroughs in understanding of biology, and we have a lot of opportunities in that regard. But I now want to turn to translational sciences. How do we take these discoveries of the basic sciences and turn those as quickly as possible into clinical applications? That's what I mean by translation. And various people will put various boundaries around it. In my mind, it's a pretty broad range of activities that go all the way from the initial identification of a possible target for developing a therapeutic to the development of a therapeutic, to its approval, to clinical application, to studies that go on beyond that, to post-marketing, to assess comparative effectiveness, to assess whether things actually work in the real world once they get applied, even to look at our healthcare systems and whether they take advantage of this information. That's all translational science. And here again, there is much of this translational science that's highly relevant to this particular gathering. I'll point again to a couple of examples that relate to brain injury. The Center for Neuroscience and Regenerative Medicine, which is a joint effort of NIH and the Uniformed Services University, aims to try to focus specifically on a whole variety of approaches to understand the consequences and potentially the ways to intervene in situation of traumatic brain injury, with a whole focus of research programs across a wide variety of approaches. Another area that I think would be of particular interest to try to understand better is, what about the risks of certain terrible outcomes that happen to warfighters that don't have to do with actually the damage coming from war injuries per se, but the risk of suicide? And those are in record levels in the Army. How do we address that? The Army, working with the National Institute of Mental Health, have put together this very broad study to look at 100,000 soldiers, a study to assess risk and resilience in soldiers, or STARS, seeking to identify whether there are risk factors for suicide that could be identified in advance and allow interventions to reduce what is otherwise a really frightening high incidence in our warfighters out there, both deployed and undeployed. And already in an early stage of this, there has been an indication of some of those predictors that might actually be practically quite useful. So those are examples highly relevant to this meeting of a sort of translational science. But let me ask in a broader sense, as we uncover, as we study the brain, some of those molecular targets that could potentially be used for the next round of therapy for Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's disease or Huntington's disease, how do we go from that fundamental knowledge to its application? I think many of us who have not really gotten into that zone and have largely focused, and I'm speaking of myself here in the past, on trying to understand molecular causes, just figure, well, you know, somebody will build a bridge. You'll have the information and this nice shiny bridge will just appear. And this is the sort of thing, of course, which the biotechnology and the pharmaceutical industry are largely involved in. But as you heard this morning from Dr. Manji, this is not such a nice shiny bridge in practice, especially for CNS disorders. It is a bridge that is very difficult to build, and it is very much fraught with high risks of failure. So maybe more likely, if you want to get across that water, don't count on the bridge. Sort of mount a few ideas about how to get across and send them off and hope that something happens. Oh dear, it's going to rain. There's going to be lightning. There are sharks in the water. Your boat hits the rocks. Only the rowboat made it, and I'm sorry to say, the other efforts here didn't turn out so well. This is more like what it's like trying to do that translational thing. But should we settle for that? Is that the best we can do? Or are there opportunities to rethink the whole process of how we go from a fundamental observation to a successful therapeutic? Could we apply engineering principles to this process in a way that hasn't really been done systematically on a large scale with open access in the past? I think yes. Well, we need to do something, because if you look at this funnel, and again, this is information reflected on this morning by Dr. Manji, the attrition is horrendous from where you start at the initial stages of drug discovery to finally, if you're fortunate, getting something all the way through the pipeline. And the timetable, as you can see down there at the bottom, is also terribly long, about 14 years. Is that good enough? No. We've got to figure out a ways to do this better than that. And as you can see, all the various stages you go through have risks, because a lot of things fall off along the way. And of course, this has been particularly devastating, I think, this situation about inefficiency and high risks of failure for diseases of the brain. Because as you heard, it is in fact particularly in the brain where the success rates are even the lowest, 8.2% in this particular study, compared to, say, infectious diseases, musculoskeletal, and so on, where success rate is better. And also, when failure happens with a CNS program, it is often failure at the latest stage in phase three, when you've already spent a huge amount of money, because it is so hard to know whether you have the right target and whether your drug is going to be effective until you've actually tried it in humans. We don't have the best possible kinds of models to assess efficacy until you get to that stage. And similarly, the timetable, if you look at the process of how it takes to get to approval, just once you've actually got a promising lead compound, CNS tends to be the longest. And for that, as you have heard, the consequences are that major companies like GSK and AstraZeneca have announced that they're pulling back or stopping altogether in terms of their CNS drug development programs, just at the point where the needs are so great and the opportunities scientifically should be mounting. So there have been many analyses about what we could do to try to re-engineer this drug development pipeline. Here's one from Steve Paul, who at that time was the director of R&D at Lilly, is now at Cornell. And the idea here is to try to do a better job of identifying the right targets and also coming up with a process where if your program is going to fail, it fails early so that you don't spend a lot of time and money chasing after something that ultimately is not going to succeed. This is that pipeline in a cartoonish sort of way. And of course, it's really much more complicated than this, and it has feedback loops that are not shown here. But I just want to emphasize a few ideas about ways in which this idea of process engineering might be applied to try to make this process more efficient and to have it go more quickly. Starting over on the left, you identify a target, which means you understand something about the molecular nature of the disease. That then allows you to go and chase, if you're doing a small molecule program, through a library and find compounds that might have activity against that target. That's HTS, or high throughput screening. Well, HTS can, of course, be accomplished in many pharmaceutical companies, and it is. But increasingly these days, HTS is also available to academics. And something that the NIH has done, and which has been particularly heavily utilized by neuroscientists, is 5 years ago to start up a molecular libraries and imaging program. And it provides the opportunity for academic investigators who've identified a potential target that maybe doesn't look like it has commercial value yet, to be able to chase down this set of processes to identify a small molecule that looks like it might have activity against that target. And this, over the course of just the last 5 years, has turned into both a training opportunity for lots of university-based scientists to become quite knowledgeable about this merging of chemistry and biology, and has also produced no less than 235 probes. And all of this gets put into a public database, again, emphasizing how useful it is for academic activity to force the idea of making these kinds of outcomes immediately accessible to all of those who are involved. Here's a couple of examples where small molecules that identify particular receptors that might be of interest to brain science have come out of this program. I could cite you many others. So this kind of approach in terms of getting investigators interested in using the small molecules to understand a way in which a pathway works and perhaps to start something that might become a campaign to develop a therapeutic is now much more widely available to academic investigators because of this program. And some have even taken this to an even more ambitious innovative strategy, and I'm particularly impressed with the work that Steve McKnight did in this one paper that came out about a year ago. So Steve wanted to ask, could you actually identify a small molecule that crosses the blood-brain barrier and protects neurons against apoptosis, against cell death? And so in a very ambitious effort, which he is quite sure would be unlikely to get funded by the standard method, but which was funded by a Pioneer Award from NIH, he conducted this kind of a screen with 1,000 small molecules in a mouse model, looking in vivo to see if he could find one that looked as if it was protective. And he found this one called P7C3, which, as you can see, compared to the control, results in the saving of a lot of neurons that otherwise would have not been able to survive. And this particular compound, whose structure you see down there, does cross the blood-brain barrier, is well tolerated, doesn't seem to have much in the way of toxicity, and actually ameliorates the decline in cognition in a rat model of Alzheimer's disease. Now, this is early on to see exactly how this turns out to be valuable, but it was a completely new approach to trying to understand a possible way to come up with a compound that might be beneficial in a category of diseases where we desperately need new ideas. And again, supported by a Pioneer Award and a transformative R01. After you have your compound, you've got to take that to the point of being something you could think about putting into animals, but then you have this preclinical phase, which is also sometimes called the valley of death, because this is where good compounds often go to die because you can't figure out a way to optimize them for absorption, distribution, metabolism, excretion, and most of all toxicology, because you don't want to give something to a human patient that you know might be harmful. Now, how do we do toxicology? Well, we do it the same way we've done it for 20 or 30 years. We test various dosages in various small and large animals, and you try to decide whether it's going to be safe on that basis. And it is commonly a reason for failure, but it's not actually that reliable, because certainly there are compounds that pass the toxicology test and still turn out to be bad for humans. And undoubtedly, there are compounds that cause some sort of worrisome signal in a mouse that would have been fine in humans. So could we do better than this? Talk about process engineering. What about this step? Well, already there is an enterprise underway involving the FDA and the NIH and the EPA, actually, because they're also interested in toxicology of a different sort, to try to see whether we could identify assays that were not dependent upon animals, but actually things you could do in a cell-based approach that would give you a reliable signal, because these would be human cells, about whether there is toxic potential for a particular compound or not. This was established 3 years ago, already has generated some interesting public data, and is moving in the direction of new ideas about how to extend this even further. One that I'm particularly fond of is, could you in fact generate using the kind of tissue engineering that is now becoming quite powerful? Not just cells growing in a monolayer, but three-dimensional or organoids representing liver or heart or kidney, and test compounds in that fashion in a way that would be much closer to what you'd see in human in vivo. And could you even do that with a whole panel of cells that were derived from different individuals whose genotypes you knew, so you could begin to look at individual differences in terms of drug response, pharmacogenomics in a test tube? Not out of the question, but certainly would require a lot of investment to go there. All of this, of course, requires a close collaboration with the FDA. If we're going to have a successful re-engineering of the pipeline, that also means the regulatory science that goes into this has to be supported. Peggy Hamburg, who will be speaking to you on Wednesday, and I have been working closely together to try to be sure we make the most of this kind of opportunity between our agencies. We have established a joint leadership council, which has broken down into a series of 6 working groups. We're supporting a regulatory science initiative and talking to each other on a very regular basis about ways to improve the process of going from left to right here with ultimate success. And then, of course, the whole process, once you get past the preclinical into clinical trials, is long, painful, and expensive. One more idea I just want to put in front of you, because it's one that has attracted a lot of interest now between academics and industry, is whether we already have in freezers or in pill bottles compounds that actually could be applied for a new purpose that we haven't tried for that particular application. We held a meeting just about a month ago with industry to ask the question whether such compounds could be made available for new applications in a way that would preserve the interests and the intellectual property of all parties. Because there are, in fact, hundreds, maybe more than hundreds, of compounds that have failed along the way in various programs, oftentimes because of lack of efficacy, and they are therefore not currently being utilized for other purposes. But those compounds are things you know a lot about. A lot has already been invested in them. Many of them have already been given to humans and found to be safe. If you could identify one of those and find that it had use in a new application, you have trimmed off years of work and maybe hundreds of millions of dollars. And we need a systematic way to test that. And I could cite you a dozen examples where that has happened by serendipity, but are we satisfied with serendipity, or could we do this in a way that's actually more organized? I think we could. This is going to be assisted by a new database that has been put together by our Chemical Genomics Center, the Pharmaceutical Collection, which is now a comprehensive resource both as compounds in tubes and as a in silico database of all clinically approved drugs approved here or in Europe. And that gives you a chance as a starting point for this kind of repurposing, because many of these compounds might find new uses if we had a systematic way to test that. And I think we now are looking forward to seeing that happen. All of this has led to a recommendation from my Scientific Management Review Board that we ought to have at NIH a hub for this kind of translational activity focused on the process and focused on applying the latest science to try to optimize that process. And that's what NCATS aims to do, the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences. It's to catalyze the development of innovative methods and technologies that will enhance the development, testing, and implementation of diagnostics and therapeutics across a wide range of human diseases and conditions. Basically, this will complement, not compete with, the private sector. It will certainly reinforce and not reduce NIH's commitment to basic research. In fact, it will probably stimulate some interesting basic science ideas. It will certainly not duplicate what NIH is already doing in the translational research arena, more than 500 such projects going on that are supported by almost all of the 27 institutes in one way or the other. It will also serve as the new home for our network of clinical and translational science awards, including some here in Boston, which is this network of 55 and soon to be 60 clinical research centers around the country, which will move into NCATS in order to bring all of this under one roof. So what's the idea? The idea is to form an integrated hub, which will be a place where we could ask and answer questions about why the process of translation is slower than one would like, and why is it prone to more failure, and how could we optimize that so that new applications for brain disorders, for heart disease, for cancers, could be carried out in a more effective way. That's the idea. And to do all of that in an open access environment. Finally, none of this is going to happen unless we have the investigators with their talents, their energies, and their vision supported in the way that they need to be to take risks. We have a number of new programs that have been instituted in the last few years to try to be sure that we are encouraging such innovation. The transformative R01s, as example. Again, Steve McKnight had one of those. The Pioneer Awards, which support exceptionally creative individual scientists. The new Innovator Awards to bring people to NIH who've never previously gotten a grant to encourage them to do so if they have an innovative idea. And a very new one, an effort to try to give the most creative graduate students the chance to move directly from PhD to independence, because there is a subset of such individuals who are ready for that and don't really need to go through that 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8 year postdoc in order to be given the chance to show what they can do. These programs, I think, have been highly successful. You saw evidence of that this morning because one of the pioneer awardees in the very first group is Carl Deisseroth, who spoke to you about optogenetics in a way that I think could not have listened to without being pretty inspired about the way this technology has transformed the approach to understanding the connectome. All of that is exciting, but this is my scary picture of the support that I think I have to put in front of this audience as a reality check for where we could go. The science is certainly in a circumstance that is ready to take off, but the support for science through the NIH, on the other hand, is really struggling. If you look at this diagram in purple, you will see what the appropriated dollars have been for the National Institutes of Health going back to 1998. You will see that doubling that happened between 98 and 2003, a wonderful opportunity to expand the biomedical research efforts and was certainly a great boost in terms of taking off in new scientific directions, finishing the genome project sooner than expected, getting many of young scientists on their way towards exciting careers. But then you'll see, starting in 2003, essentially a plateau with very minor increments over the year. You'll see the Recovery Act dollars in 09 and 10, which was a wonderful opportunity to tap into pent-up demand for research dollars, but that was a two-year program. It's over. We were not allowed to carry those funds beyond those 2 years with a few very small exceptions. Now, the scary part is if you look at the yellow bars, because that basically takes into account the aspects of the Biomedical Research and Development Price Index. And you will see that has eroded the buying power of NIH quite substantially. In 2011, after the continuing resolution was passed only about a month ago, you can see where we ended up. And if you draw a line, basically our buying power now is about where it was 10 years ago. And as you heard from Ed Markey, it's not at all clear where we'll be in 2012. What you see there is the president's budget, but certainly what has been proposed in the initial recommendation in the House would bring the NIH budget substantially below what you see there, according to the chairman's recommendation for the allocation to that committee. This is the thing that keeps me awake at night, because we are now at the point where if you're a grantee with a great new idea and you come to the NIH with your application, your chances of getting funded, which traditionally have been in the neighborhood of 1 in 3, are now more like 1 in 6. And that means 5 out of 6 are going to go away with no support. And particularly for early stage investigators who are trying to get their careers going, that sort of gets you to a tipping point where you begin to wonder whether there's a career trajectory there for you or not. And so there could not be a more appropriate time to have a gathering like this to talk about the enormous potential for science to move us forward and to come up with answers to all of those diseases that currently we don't understand, don't know how to prevent, don't know effectively how to treat, than right now. Certainly what Ed Markey said about Alzheimer's disease should be a wake-up call to anybody who's looked at those statistics and considered the enormous personal cost to families, to individuals, and to our society. And yet what we are doing to try to invest in a better time is certainly far less than what we could do with the ideas, with the talents that are currently available. And so I want to congratulate one more time Patrick for bringing this opportunity to everybody's attention, to seeing this as a parallel to what happened 50 years ago, to encouraging all of us to think boldly and audaciously about what that might be. Our president has certainly been documenting his own enthusiasm for this, about talking about innovation and education and outbuilding the rest of the world. And we at the NIH want very much to be part of that, to unleash that talent, that energy, that creativity, to turn discovery into health, and to be, as we have been exhorted today to be, the National Institute of Hope. Thank you all very much.